Hello, everyone, and good morning. Today is Saturday, October 10th, 2020, and we're welcoming you to our Saturday morning Bible study. We are recording from the Plainfield Christian Science Church Independent, Plainfield, New Jersey, the United States of America. Thanks for joining us. And Thomas from New York is our moderator today.
Oh, welcome, and hello to everybody who's joined us. So I'll start out with the quotes we have. First one is, the spiritual requirements of truth are now not only imperative in their nature, but always bring a blessing in their obedience. And this blessing shows itself on our bodies in harmony and health. Just as the science of mathematics shows itself upon the figures if they are controlled after a principle of truth, instead of being controlled according to a belief that cannot be understood through demonstration, but will result in error of some sort. This was the principle, wisdom or God, upon which truth or Christ founded his church or body. The liberty of the gospel. Outside of the laws of matter, which are beliefs, and in the principle of science, never varying in its equitable fulfillment. That's from Essay and Other Footprints, commonly known as the Red Book by Mary Baker Eddy. And then the other one is Moses addresses the nation as such, and reminds them of their dullness to apprehend the manifestations of God's grace, which had been so abundantly afforded in their past history, in order that he may arouse them to a better state of mind and stimulate them to hearken to the voice of God in the future. Now, this is from the pulpit commentary.
Thank you.
You couldn't have found better quotes for your for this Bible study. They're just amazing. Wonderful. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And whoever has their computer on, could you turn it the volume down because we're getting an echo, please?
Okay, comments with this?
I feel like that's why we do these Bible studies and classes, to arouse us to a better state of mind, so we hearken to God now and in the future.
Yeah, I mean, these are timeless.
Yeah.
And they like the fact that the spiritual requirements of truth are imperative.
Thank you.
We don't have a choice.
Thank you. That's it. Imperative.
Yeah. That's like mathematics. Yeah. And if you can, and people of even simplicity can take it to that, as she directs, it just opens a whole new way of thinking. This is beautiful.
It is. It exactly goes along with the what Moses' speech. Third speech. It's amazing. Yeah. If you want harmony in your own life and in your nation, these are imperative. It's not optional.
And I like what she says, that it can be understood through demonstration. In other words, the only way to understand the laws of God are to put them into practice, prove them to yourself, and thereby understand that they are in fact true. It's not something that you can just learn in a class and get it without actually putting it into practice. It's not something that you can inherit from your parents or grandparents. It's for each one of us, it's between us and God. and we prove it for ourselves, or we fail to prove it. We fail to put it into practice and therefore don't understand it.
And it says it's never varying in its equitable fulfillment. So what does that mean?
For everybody?
It's for everybody. No one is left out. And just like math, anyone can prove it. No one is left out on this. Everyone, everywhere. Doesn't matter what your background is, where you live, anything. It's equitable.
And it is the only equity.
It is.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as human equity. All these politicians talking about inequitable stuff. Well, the answer is we are all equitably able to have this blessing from God. And we are all equitable in God's sight. And that is the ideal that our human laws try to enforce.
And then the dullness, Moses addresses the nation, reminds them of their dullness to apprehend the manifestations of God's grace. Because you think over and over the incredible healings that went on, over and over and over, and then they still whine, still afraid, they still don't get it. And that goes on today. And the point being made, it's not that these wonderful, we're going to mute people because we're getting an echo. And if we don't know where it's coming from, if you're muted, that's why.
The reason why.
And then it's not because we don't want you to talk. It's because the echo is not acceptable, wherever it's coming from. Anyway, so it's not that the miracles haven't happened and are still happening. It's the dullness that people don't get it or see it. And in the commentary I was reading, and it made such a good point, this is what we need to pray for, that people see it and recognize it and accept it and are grateful for it. And as Mrs. Eddy says, they're not miracles. They're not supernatural. It's in this week's lesson. They're divinely natural. David in Florida gave that testimony, his father being healed in the last stages of cancer. Now the hospital recognized it. He worked in the Plainfield High School. Everybody recognized it. Did we get one person coming to church because of that? No. So this is a phenomena or something that people don't get it. So instead of complaining about it or saying that there are no miracles, you better pray to see that there are, and it's going on right in front of your nose.
I mean, you know, Jesus had it, didn't he? He talked about those with a hardened heart who would not accept and be healed to their own detriment. He healed 10 lepers, and how many came back to find out what was going on?
One.
Yeah, 1 out of 10. Our prayer should be that the other 9 will wake up.
I think it's important to see how deeply unfulfilling the other way is. I know I was not fulfilled by my life. That's why I wanted out. So so I think of that often in my watches. People just need to realize that they're not fulfilled by this stuff. So, and it is funny how the Israelites just kept murmuring, you know, every it seemed like every 40 minutes, what have you done for me lately, kind of a thought.
I know.
No, we should go back where we were. This is terrible.
See, today I'm hungry. Come on. Today I'm thirsty. You know, what's wrong with our God?
Today we have to go over the Red Sea.
One of the commentaries referred to it as bow gratitude.
Well, I didn't understand when I first found Christian Science and decided to do it. I couldn't understand why it was not helping me at all. But then, I got no help until I came to Plainfield.
Well, thank you. And that this is why, as Linda just said, we do this all the time, and to keep people awake and rousing everyone so we're not asleep. And it's been my experience, and I'm speaking of myself as well. Those who have had Christian Science all their lives, I've never been officially class taught, but many of them class taught. They're the ones that complain the most. Well, why aren't there more instantaneous healings? And it's just so whining. And if you really feel that, well, you become a practitioner and you start demonstrating these instantaneous healings, okay? Let's see you do it, and then we'll all be happy. So
I think it's because most have just, lived where something goes wrong and parents call practitioner and, healing happens. So I think the teaching of, how to even start appreciating God, being so grateful for him and all that, that's missed. So it's not surprising that it's like, okay, instantly heal me and then I'm a Christian Scientist. So.
Thank you.
Right.
That's right. And I think people don't really want to work for it. We work to solve problems in math. If you want to be a good pianist, you have to practice. It takes effort. And some people just don't want that. They just want, like Florence said, the healing.
And doesn't Mrs. Eddy say that in Science and Health?
Yeah.
Maybe if they instantaneously turned on a dime quicker.
Sorry, Joe, I had to mute you. Go ahead.
Maybe if people instantaneously turned on a dime, they'd have their healing quicker.
Yeah.
And Moses was always talking about the stiff-necked people. They were being willful and wanted it their way.
Yeah.
Well, I think
I've been guilty of that one from time to time.
Yeah, it's
so thing. I wanted to just make a comment about the first quote. I selected it, but just to kind of give you my thought process. There's so much bundled up into this quote that it's almost endless what I think you can learn from this. It all seems very simple as you read through it, but then there's so much here. So I hope people will go back and read this later and think about it. And I also want to point out what's such a benefit. We were talking about, people coming to the Plainfield Church or not or whatever. But this quote here is something that the normal Christian Scientist is actually forbidden to read, but not at Plainfield.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We can read this and gain from this. And so we should be very thankful for the Plainfield Church for bringing this to the world.
Thank you.
And the Plainfield Church is thankful to God for separating us from ecclesiastical despotism.
Yeah.
I think that what Thomas just said is actually going back to that business about being equitable. So so everybody that has joined the Plainfield Church or was in the Plainfield Church must have been too lazy at one point to understand Christian Science or to do the work. No, I don't believe that for one second. But maybe that not being equitable, is the CSBOD right now, are they equitable? Did they treat Plainfield equitably? Did they allow everybody to read what they thought was the right thing to read? Or did they censor things? So maybe another key to this whole puzzle is being equitable to everybody. Maybe we aren't allowed. I was reading all that Deuteronomy and just amazed me what's in there. And it very much says that the hewer and the water drawer have to be treated fairly. And are we treating everybody, not we as meaning Plainfield, we as a nation, we as a world, are we treating everybody equitably?
Thank you.
God's love.
Well, that is certainly the ideal, and that is the science. That is the principle of the science. It is equitable in its fulfillment. So that's why we never personalize anything that happens anywhere. We're grateful to the board of directors in Boston for getting rid of us, for kicking us out of a corrupt organization. We're actually grateful to them. They didn't know any better, but it was God's will that we be separated from it and become independent. This is human progress. You know, as we look at the history of mankind, we need to emphasize the progress, the good things that are happening, because the bulk of mankind is still living in enslavement of one form or another. All enslavement is wrong. All enslavement is inequitable. That's why we can't personalize anything. And we need to be grateful for the good that God provides for us.
You see, if we had, we could have just dwelt and say how unjust this was. This wasn't equitable to be kicked out. We could have just ruminated over the injustice of all of this. But instead, we turned to our science and to our divine rights and rose above the inequity, which is what is available to all people. And that's what she says there, that, you know, never varying. So no matter what injustice is thrown your way, and how awful it seems, you can make, as they say, lemonade out of the lemon. If you, as Gary just said, if you can impersonalize it and turn to your God, and this is why we study the Bible stories, because look at all of them that did that. Look at the inequity that Joseph suffered, that Daniel suffered, good grief that Christ Jesus suffered, that Mrs. Eddy suffered. Life is not everything just all the time. Sometimes it's terribly unjust. So what are you going to do about that? If you just complain and whine and hate what's been done to you, you'll just dig yourself further and further into the hole. But if you turn to your Father and start working the problem out according to science, you will rise up higher than you've ever dreamed possible.
That's exactly what I was, the point I was making was that nobody at Plainfield was lazy. I mean, and you've proved that you dug in and you dug even deeper and worked even harder and overcame it. And the one reason I object to this laziness is because I would work from the farmer. I would work from 6 in the morning until 10 at night in the summer every day from snow gone to snow fall. And then they told me the reason the farmers weren't doing well was because we were lazy. And my farm, my sister and I, we were doing fine, but we were just saw the inequality of how farmers were treated versus the, other people.
Right. And everybody is treated badly by the human mind. Okay, so farmers are not alone in that problem.
Right. Yeah, the human mind equally treats everyone with garbage.
Right. And it's out to enslave you. That's what the carnal mind does.
Right.
It's an enslaver and a dictator.
And just as you might found, the answer is not in a human system. The answer is in the science of Christianity. That is the answer. And that is why we spend so much time preparing for our Bible studies and our roundtables and our services.
And equitable doesn't always mean the same either. No. There's always this sense that it has to all look the same for everybody or be the same.
Yeah, the equitable is in the opportunity.
Yeah, the opportunity.
And the only thing that is equitable is the science of Christianity, God's law.
And one thing that kept us, one other point, not being lazy was Mrs. Evans. We could have very easily just dropped into laziness and accepted it and all of that. But there was no way that was happening while she was around. None of us worked harder. She was, you know, wielding the whip, so to speak. So
she was a fighter for the truth.
Yeah.
So I'm just checking, but was there someone out there who wants to say something?
I think Florence.
No, I was going to say that, yes, just as you said, because Mrs. Evans was there, you could turn to what's true and, you know, get what was needed at the time. But that's why I feel so strongly that the injustice is the portrayal of what God is and what Christianity is in such a contrary way or misunderstanding where people don't know what God is and don't have this feeling that, look, there's a God who loves all. This message is, it's so prevalent here, but it's not elsewhere. And that's why I feel that justice that comes from Christian Science and the Bible, thank God for Mrs. Eddy's, what has come through her for the whole world to know. When people know this, I'm sure lives will be changing.
Thank you. Exactly. And that is why we keep our websites as good as they are. That is why we translate the word of God into so many languages. That is why we do what we do. And we give it freely for that purpose. Thank you, Florence.
Yeah, the universe.
Thank you. So I think we should jump into our questions. Our Bible study for the day.
Thank you.
So it's great that these quotes generate a lot of discussion. Very, very, very great hearing this. So our topic is Moses' third speech. Our readings are in Deuteronomy chapters 28 through 30. If someone wants to get very professorial and academic, that's okay. But, you know, how you define the different sermons or speeches in Deuteronomy, I think it's a little hazy there, but people do think that there are multiple speeches, and this is the third one. So as long as we're okay with this on a ballpark level, let's say, right? So our first question, I hope we have fun with this, is who are the Amorites? So it mentions a couple people, Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan. Who are Amorites, but who are these Amorites, and who are the kings, too?
Well, there were certain highland mountaineers who inhabited the land of Canaan, and Canaan in the Bible signifies the consciousness of man under the dominion of the carnal mind, and they were giants also. And it was very important that Moses and the people defeated these giants. It was described as almost a miraculous and unimaginable event. But I found something very interesting about Heshbon, king of Heshbon, the Amorite. In Israel, when you want a check at a restaurant, you ask for the Heshbon. So a Heshbon is a bill, an accounting. It requires one to take a look at the costs and see how things add up. And to them, a Heshbon requires logic and reason. So the Heshbon was what was needed to be overcome, conquered and overcome, in order for the Israelites to reach their destiny. In other words, they had to overcome the logic and the reasoning of the human mind and turn to the divine mind completely. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, the Amorites occupied the land that the Israelites had to go through to get across the Jordan River to where they were supposed to go, right? In other words, it was the last part of the desert, you know, of their journey to get to where they were supposed to go. And they would wander around for 40 years, and it was time for them to stop wandering around. So this was the last challenge, if you will, before they were to go across the Jordan River. And it appeared to be a big challenge, didn't it?
Yes, it was in their way. They had to go.
And, yeah, they asked the Amorites nicely if they could just go across their land, if they would. But the Amorites said no, and then they attacked, the Israelites.
From what I found, they stuck around to the Amorites. They just didn't all disappear. I think that I'm correct on this, and the dictionary, Bible dictionary. And it wasn't until Solomon that they were really brought to bondservants and totally subdued.
And some of the descriptions, I mean, this was in the marriage of Martu, a Sumerian creation legend that took place in the distant past, even in biblical times, when a blushing bride weds an Amorite. The Amorite, he is dressed in sheepskins. He lives in tents and wind and rain. He doesn't offer sacrifices. Armed vagabond in the mountains, he digs up truffles and is restless. He eats raw meat, lives without a home, and when he dies, he's not buried according to proper rituals. And then also, the former terrible giants gave way to the Amorites, an evil and sinful people whose wickedness surpasses that of any others and whose life will be cut short on earth. Their black art, their witchcraft, and impure mysteries by which they contaminated Israel in the time of Judges. And then probably some of you have seen that Og was buried in a sarcophagus or stone coffin, which was measured 14 feet long by 6 feet wide, made of iron. Hmm. So this guy was huge.
That was his bed.
That was his bed, yes. So, I mean, they just painted this dreadful picture. It's very interesting. Who knew about the Amorites like this? So, but then in talking about it, it says, you know, to put it more on a personal level, so to speak, which is what Joe was speaking about as well. It says, giants represent our intimidating realities. What is your reality? Our obstacles may seem giant, insurmountable, may delay us from even getting started. If we listen to these voices of reason and logic, there is no way we would ever reach our goals. What matters more is the reality of God. And that is the way these dreadful obstacles were overcome, was only through God. So whatever your obstacle, no matter how huge and horrible it looks, and eating, you know, that terrible description of them, doesn't matter if you have God with you. The principle of science never varies in its equitable fulfillment. So wherever you are, whatever obstacle you're facing, God is there to help you overcome it, as he did with the Israelites.
And the smallest truth is bigger than the largest evil or whatever.
Absolutely, it is, yes. And you can prove it for yourself.
Quite some time ago, we had a Bible study about Joshua and Caleb giving the good report when they came back. Mm-hmm. And then in that, it said that Caleb wanted the part of the land that had the giants. He was willing to go do that. And I don't know, I've thought of that since then, that willingness to take the hard path. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Caleb was the one who went into the promised land, not Moses. It was Caleb, because he met the giants.
Yeah, and overcame them.
Yeah.
Well, I thought what was fascinating is the name Og. It's got to be the best name for a giant, right? Og the giant.
Well, I was thinking, who has a baby and name of Og?
Father.
So one of the things I found out about the Amorites is they have an ancient history. They're not quite sure where they really came from, except maybe Mesopotamia area somewhere. But they've been around a long time. And there was at one point where one of them was the king of Babylon. So his name was Hammurabi. So I only vaguely knew about this, but I'm sure people have heard this somewhere, but there's the Code of Hammurabi, which what they found is in the Louvre right now.
Interesting.
Mm. Yeah.
So they have quite a history. So they have a long culture, a long history. They have giants among their group of people. So these aren't just anybody. These people are very significant in certain ways. So that could be formidable to the Israelites and scary, too, at the same time.
Yes. Yeah, very interesting. I didn't know all this. Yeah.
Hmm. It reminds me of Joshua and Caleb going in there with others. Some saw a massive problem and some saw an opportunity. Yeah, we can do this.
Yes.
And other people are just terrified. Like you mentioned, delayed your start. In this case, delayed it 40 years.
Yeah, you don't. If you think about all the obstacles, many people just freeze. They don't even try. And that goes back to the laziness discussion. You know, you can call it whatever you want. It's the carnal mind who freezes and chokes. And
the human mind is lazy.
Yeah, the human mind always. It just won't go forward. But the divine mind is enterprising and will figure out a way to go forward always. That was another requirement by Mrs. Evans. You never took no for an answer. You know, if you said, that you can't do this, well, you'd say, well, yes, we can, and we'll do it. And there was always a way. Mm-hmm. And Carpenter, and that's why those books by him are so valuable. I believe it's in Precepts. He says it's good to come up under a seeming insurmountable situation. Because as Bruce was just saying, it gives you the opportunity to prove with God all things are possible. It's a wonderful attitude, way of life that science should give us.
Thank you for that. Because I know I was thinking earlier, as far in regard to people complaining, I know a lot of times people feel pointing out problems means they did something, but that doesn't. That's just the seed of it. You got to actually do something about it, and that's one thing I'm grateful to Christian Science in this church for. Is it? Provides the way to do something.
And that, you know, Jeremy gets this. People will, look at this problem or that problem, and they give it to him to solve. Mrs. Evans used to say, because she gets it too, practitioners get it. She said, don't ever come to me with a problem unless you have a solution. Just do not. I don't want to hear about it. That causes a person to overcome his inertia and try to get someone else to do the work. If the problem has come to you, you should be the one who can figure it out, because you wouldn't have it
if you weren't ready
and capable for it.
This says something about pioneers, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
People who are willing to
do the impossible.
Yes, who are willing to raise humanity to a better level. Mm. You know, it's easy to look around and see everything that's wrong. I mean, that's easy. It doesn't require a lot of energy. It doesn't require any energy, actually, to do that. But to do something about it, to be a real pioneer, to do something that is progress for mankind, you have to overcome that human mind inertia that doesn't want to.
And sees all the obstacles.
So when we see people who have really lifted mankind a notch higher, Mrs. Eddy, of course, Christ Jesus, all the apostles,
Moses,
and you can look outside of the church, you can look to people who have really accomplished things and overcome obstacles. I mean, I think, Albert Einstein, It just is sort of an example outside of the Bible, outside of religion. People who have the Constitution of the United States of America, the people who actually signed it, who put their lives at danger, at risk, to sign something that they saw would be an improvement for all mankind.
Martin Luther King Jr.
Absolutely. There are people throughout history who have put their lives on the line to promote a higher cause.
But John Lewis.
There are hundreds. There are thousands. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, each one of us here today has the opportunity to be one of those, mm-hmm. if you want to be. We have something that will solve every problem in the world. We have it at our fingertips. What are we doing about it? Ask yourself. We should all ask ourselves, what are we doing about it? Yeah, we're all grateful for the Plainfield Church. We're all grateful for Mrs. Evans. We're all grateful for the board of directors for kicking us out. But we've got something here that the world needs.
And what, you know, what I see and what I've learned to find that is maybe one of the worst forms of the human mind are those who stand on the sidelines and criticize and throw stones at those who are doing just what Gary said, who are bucking the tide, are willing to put their lives on the line. And it's so easy just to stand on the side and say, well, you should have done it that way, or you were, you know, you should have done this. And to any of that, I say, well, what have you done? And then I'll listen to you. And that's all. Anytime that comes up, I say, well, what in the heck have you done that you're so critical? And then I'll listen. Because we saw it with Mrs. Evans, people throwing stones at her. Well, what did you do for the cause of science? And let's see how you would have done it. Could you have done it, you know, with your posies in your hair and all of this? It took someone tough like her. So that to me is a despicable form of the human mind that stands in the sidelines and criticizes and throws stones on those who are doing all the work. It's like, thanks a lot. So anyway.
And Jesus called them out, didn't he?
He sure did.
When they brought Mary Magdalene to him, he called them out.
So for those who want to read a little bit more about the Amorites, it's in chapter 3 of Deuteronomy, where there's some write-up of those two kings and the iron bed and so forth. And in terms of them being formidable, I also mention in there, it says that their cities were fenced with high walls, gates, and bars. So they were formidable. So on question two, we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on this, but I think it's helpful to sort of understand when we're reading these chapters, like who is saying them, where were they saying them, what's, you know. So question is, what is the context of this speech?
To rouse them. And warn them.
Oh, maybe we can talk about that in question four. But I mean, I'm talking more about like, where were they? Why were they? When was this?
This was
just
the last.
So everybody who's listening sort of understands, like, when we talk about this speech.
This is the last speech that Moses gave to the Israelites before he died and before they crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land.
And before they did the things that were recorded in the book of Joshua, were many things.
Right.
There was a prep.
He was also speaking to a new generation, the generation of those who got the Ten Commandments, that he delivered the Ten Commandments to the, were the ones that went through the wilderness for 40 years. So this was a new generation of people that had... grown up to come through the wilderness. But so he was renewing the covenant that he made, that was made with God, actually went back as far as Abraham. That's where the covenant first came from, was with Abraham and his descendants. But it was to renew the covenant with the new generation that was going to go in, and to promise them that if they obeyed, and that they needed to obey, it was for future generations forever. It wasn't just for them. It was for those who were yet to come. And from what I read, it was also, it wasn't just for them. There were some Gentiles, but something to do with the Gentiles, too. It was just, it was for all mankind. And that they anyway, so that's, and that they, yeah, like you said, they were just about to go into the promised land now. And I think, too, Moses had just, the reason why he wasn't allowed to go in with them was because he was disobedient. And I think from his experience, he realized, you know, he was speaking from his own experience, that I've done all this, but then the last thing, I was disobedient, and now I can't go into the promised land. So he was also speaking from experience. It had to do with the rock, bringing water out of the rock, in case anybody is wondering.
But that was wonderful. Thank you very much for that overview. That was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to tell us about the next question about when Moses was saying about how the Israelites were protected.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So the question is, how were the Israelites protected when they left Egypt and during their journey in the wilderness?
Well, first they had the pillar of cloud by day and the fire by night, which never over 40 years, never left them in their travels. And going to the promise, going into the world, they're leaving Egypt. It was there constantly. And then in the 40 years that they were in the desert, their clothes and shoes did not wax old. They always had plenty of food and water. Always, without interruption or diminution. And they all their supplies were met during that 40 year in the desert. The manna that was there every day, they were not given more than they needed. Each day they had what they needed, but not more. So every day they had to just expect and just trust that it would be there the next day, and it always was. They didn't get more so they could store it and put it away. And it was, they got what they needed daily. So it was a proof of, are you daily going to trust that the next day you will have what you need? So it was a tremendous 40 years or 38. Actually, they made it in 2 years. It was another 38 years that they got too scared, and they didn't want to go into the promised land. So that's why they were given another 38 years in the wilderness. But despite the fact that they were feared, they got all these blessings during that time. And to show them, this is what you can expect for the rest of your life if you continue to obey the laws. And so... anyway,
I think that's amazing, and I think the also is that a point is that Moses was the one that made the main demonstration. He had help from Aaron and Miriam and Caleb and Joshua at various times, obviously, but the main one to do the demonstration was like Mary Baker Eddy was Moses, and did have the helpers. And it would have been nice if everybody had gotten on the same page, and then he probably could have gotten into the promised land, too.
Yeah,
that's right. No, he fulfilled his mission, and he fulfilled it well.
Yeah, he certainly did.
Yeah.
I read the generation of unbelief had died. And now this was the generation of faith. And God is always running out, you know, for progress, as he did in, what was the story of the band, Gideon's band.
Gideon's band.
But yes, Moses certainly fulfilled his mission.
And while they were wandering, their clothes never wore out. Their shoes never wore out. And as was said, they were fed every day.
They probably wouldn't have made it till 38 years if Moses hadn't been there.
Definitely not.
Well, you know, if I could say about this reading in Deuteronomy, it says, "Hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God." And then there's a list of blessings. Everybody likes the blessings. But the requirement is to listen diligently, hearken diligently. I got to believe that that's what Moses was doing to during this time. Because imagine the long walk to the wet Red Sea from the Egypt area. I mean, who's going to walk that long? Pick up the things and walk that long? Unless someone was there to hearken diligently. And in the next few days on the other side of the Red Sea, if they would have been more grateful and thankful for these wonderful things that happened, maybe they wouldn't have been so hungry and thirsty.
Or maybe it wouldn't have taken them 40 years.
Well, that's absolutely the point, because, again, what Bruce just relayed was the water out of the rock, the parting of the Red Sea. All that was when everybody was complaining, and then Moses turned directly to God, and the problem was solved by God. And so it was Moses that was the one being the practitioner.
Mm-hmm. And as we talked about earlier, it was that they needed... yet the Lord had not given you a heart to perceive and eyes to see and ears to hear to this very day. So a prayer is that people do have the eyes to see what God has done and is doing. And as Florence brought out, that yes, it extends to the world. And it is, because many, many people demonstrate science and don't even know that it's science. They just understand the rules and live them. And it blesses them.
And I think that's what Moses meant at the end of chapter 29, where he says, "The secret things belong unto the Lord our God. But those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." We are blessed for one purpose, to see and recognize what a good God we have, and to obey the law as a result.
Yeah. I thought he was also given the key to his success, was that he had to keep remembering your history and the greatness that God has done, and that kept me going forward, and it'll keep you and the rest of your in the future, going forward, his third speech. It doesn't seem that he really was trying to give them something that was so important. Mary?
Well, that's what I was thinking. Like, so he's reminding them, and of course there was also mentioned that this is kind of like the next generation that may not experience these, but he's reminding them that they were protected by God, and now they're going to be faced with some huge challenges when they go into the land of Israel. And so if they're going to be scared or waver, remember how God protected them. This is, in a way, is not just for the Israelites going into the land of Israel, but as you were saying, this is for all of us. So that to me is kind of, I mean, it's very simple, but the reason for the question three was that, you know, God will protect us.
If we hearken diligently.
If, there's a big if there.
Exactly.
Very big gift.
It's his heart and soul many times in this in these chapters. With all your heart and soul.
Yeah. And it also, I mean, it brings out, it's, yes, individually, and this is for a nation as well. And that, you know, people wonder what the heck's going on when people don't hearken to God's laws. And that's what's happening in our country now. What the heck is going on? Well, we haven't hearkened to God's laws in many ways. And we have an opportunity now to all get on our knees and get back to that.
Yeah. People have brought out Haggai before.
In Haggai, I will shake the nations. Go ahead.
You know, we have a choice to make. And this is what, you know, came to me last week, that the idea of choice, we have an election, a mental election to make. And that's the true election. You know, we're going to choose God or we're going to choose not to obey.
And that's right. And this election is not about people. It's about obedience to God, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Unfortunately, too many people are going to look at this election as people.
And personality.
And personality. And they will be blinded to the facts that are important. We need to recognize everything we do, it's not about people. It's about obeying God's law or not. And even Moses says here, he says, I set before you life and death. I set before you, you know, peace and war. Choose life.
Also in...
Well, good. I just want to say we have moved into question 4, but I'll read that.
Right.
What was the purpose of this speech? So it's also could be phrased, you know, what are we going to learn from this speech? I'll just read one thing here. So this is chapter 29. Verse 9, keep therefore the words of this covenant and do them, that ye may prosper in all that ye do. Now, I think there were a couple of people out there, one just now and one earlier, who wanted to say something. You want to jump in here now. I'll make sure you have your opportunity.
I was just going to say, when you had 28:1-14 to read in it, and the gist of that was that it's better to be drawn, when I said, better to be drawn to what is good by a childlike hope of God's favor rather than frightened into it by slavish fear. So you want to be, you know, stressing the obedience out of love for God, not because of some fear that something awful is going to happen, but it's out of the love of God that assures our obedience and continues, because our love for God then grows and grows.
Thank you. That's so true. You know, when I had this fear of God and tried to do things because I was afraid of God, that's just not sustaining. You know, you can't obey something you fear for any length of time. It won't work. The only way you can continue to obey through stormy or shining weather is love for God, and that will sustain you during the storms. And then, too, when the storms are over and things look great, it will also sustain you and it'll keep you from falling asleep or getting complacent. It's the love for God, always, not fear. Florence?
No, that has enthusiasm. The rest, you know, I'm doing it because of this or because of this, that doesn't, it doesn't last.
No.
Because you're afraid of punishment.
And that's why the purpose of this speech was to reinforce to everybody their covenant with God, their relationship with God. He was going to leave them, and they were going to have to. He was giving them the best of what he knew, the best of what he had learned. And I like Mrs. Eddy's definition of Moses. A corporeal mortal, moral courage, a type of moral law and the demonstration thereof. That is what Moses did for them. The proof that without the gospel, the union of justice and affection, there is something spiritually lacking, since justice demands penalties under the law. So he was giving them God's blessing and warning them how life would be if they turned away from that blessing.
Yeah, and it talks about where he blesses him, the Bible, he blesses himself in his heart saying, I have peace. And this commentary says, a rank sinner may feel confident in his own heart, having a marvelous sense of peace. But this peace is an illusion. It is the peace of the blind, of the unknowing. If a bomb is on a plane and most everyone on the plane is at peace the moment before the bomb explodes, but their peace is based on their ignorance. In the same way, a sinner may completely be untroubled in his heart, but this is only because he is blind.
Spiritually lacking.
Yes. So, and then also from Deuteronomy, so that the coming generation of your children who rise up after you and the foreigner who comes from a far land would say when they see the plagues of the land and the sicknesses, the whole land is brimstone burning, it is not sown nor does bear nor does any grass grow there. All nations would say, why has the Lord done this? And the people would say, because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. But they went and served other gods and worshiped them. So.
And in science, we learn that God doesn't do it.
That the error does it
to itself.
Yes. But, you know, people who are watching America now, look, well, how can it be so great? Look at all our troubles. Look what's going on there. Cities are burning, storms, and it's never because of God. It's always a lack of God. And the reason we're having it is to get people to turn to God, because that's the only Savior there is.
I think that word servant. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I just said it's also not the first time that this kind of thing has happened.
No, it happens over and over.
We get whatever we need to wake us up.
Yes, thank you. Yep. Mike, were you speaking?
Yes, I was going to say where you read that word serve, and I kind of look at it as being a debtor. If we're a debtor to our God, we're fine, but if we go and serve or become in debt to false gods, that's when we run into problem, and that's exactly what's going on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we should. We can learn.
Yeah, it has to come.
Go ahead.
That was all for me. Anyone else?
Oh, I just want to say this is perfect, because I want to mention a verse that just speaks of just what you were talking about. So, where it says, the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the nations, whither the Lord thy God hath scattered thee. So, I read this text not because don't focus too much on coming back from all the other nations, but focus on the word captivity, that it will turn thy captivity. So I looked up the word captivity in Webster's, and it says here, the state of being a prisoner or of being in the power of an enemy by force or the fate of war.
Wow.
But also, number two says, subjection to love. So we can look at this like, okay, who's controlling us? Are we being obedient to God, or are we subject to other forces? whether it be physical, mentally, or spiritually.
Well, doesn't Paul refer to himself as the captive of Christ?
Yeah. And the design of love is to
reform the sinner.
Reform the sinner. Mm-hmm. So it is love, because I know, even though my life seemed okay before coming here and learning what I did, I mean, outwardly it seemed okay. Inwardly, I was so miserable. And if I hadn't gone through all I'd gone through, I never would have learned what true peace and security and living a fearless life is like. I would have just remained in that churning, fearful, negative existence. It took the hard knocks to get you to drop it like a hot potato. Eventually, you just drop it like a hot potato. All that fearful, negative thinking, it becomes obnoxious. Where originally I didn't know what was wrong with that, because that's how I thought. That makes sense.
Well, and that's why the only way you can understand God's law is to obey it and experience and walk through the fires.
Yes.
And walk through the problems.
And when he says fear not, that means fear not. It doesn't mean to, okay, go ahead and fear. He's saying fear not.
And when you feel, don't let it stop you.
Yeah, from going forward.
So I'll bring you back to the quote that we started out with from the Red Book. You know, this is from Mary Baker Eddy. So she talks about the liberty of the gospel. So here it is. She's telling us this can free us from any captivity we might have that's not God-like. The liberty of the gospel.
Thank you.
Well, yes. Frees us from the so-called laws of matter.
And again, we can all think about making your covenant with God. It was something we've taught here. Mr. Evans taught it to us. I'm sure it's a large part of why I'm still here. You make that covenant, you don't break it. It's between you and God. And you give your total obedience to him, and he will take care of you. And it's individual, it's also collective, and it's most important, as we see here, because all of these troubles come from breaking the covenant.
One of the things, I know we're kind of late, but what really struck me was I decided to look up what it was like to be enslaved. And actually, in many cases, it wasn't necessarily suffering for everyone. But what they did weep for was the loss of God and their church and the Jerusalem. And in Psalm 137, the first line says, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion." And then later in that psalm, it talks about, "Remember, O Lord, the children of Eden in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundations thereof." And raise means to completely destroy buildings and towns, just wipe it all out. So these children of Eden came in and wiped out Jerusalem, and they're sorrowful for it. And one of the things that I found consistent through these captives was this desire to wipe out their faith and to take away, wean them away from the worship of God and rename them and reteach them. And and the stuff that they were exposed to, almost like to take away their sense of belonging to something. And it was their love for Jerusalem, but in the Holy Temple, that's what they meant. And they find, they said, if you go through some of the Psalms, that's what they were reading, was for the Holy Temple.
Wow.
Right. And one of our founding fathers, I think it was George Washington, said, "You can never enslave a Bible reading."
No, that was Horace Greeley.
Horace Greeley, okay. Whatever.
Anyway, a Bible reading nation, you can never enslave it, because it understands these truths, and this is why these Bible studies are so important.
Which is why we have to get the Bible back into our schools.
Yeah.
Because the devil took it out.
Yeah, yes. It did. And yeah, and you see, our nation has been so blessed, hasn't it? And yet we still complain and whine and carry on. And so now, okay, well, let's see how we do if we lose all this stuff. See how you feel then, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You lose your liberty, your freedom to worship and other things. Are we going to be like these people mourning it? I know, you know, I've told you, I got this report about in China, where all of this communist China, you can't pray and study. And people have whole chapters of the Bible memorized because the Bible gets taken away from them.
Right, because they're not allowed to congregate in churches.
Yeah.
Wonderful. See if you can take it from my thinking. You
can't.
Right. Well, and that same error is trying to impose that enslavement anywhere it can. Yeah. It's working right here in the middle of our nation.
It's a carnal mind. Mm-hmm. And the carnal mind always is that way. And it is a dictator. It enslaves. Yes, it is. So.
The definition you gave of the Amorites being, you know, without a home, without like a purpose, even just sort of like living around, eating raw meat and all that. I feel that's kind of what it seems like the human mind wants from us, to not feel that we have any connection to anything.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Well,
rip it away.
And Mrs. Evans reminded us many, many times, the human mind is a murderer. That is its sole objective.
Yeah.
Never forget, the human mind is a murderer. It's not your friend.
That's why you stay out of it.
And stay away from it.
And stay away from it.
I found that quote by Horace Greeley, and he says, "It is impossible to enslave mentally or socially a Bible-reading people. The principles of the Bible are the groundwork of human freedom."
Wow.
Thank you very much.
That may be a good ending. Thank you.
Yep. Amen. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, everybody else.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas.